With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Happy Friday and welcome back to the Weekly Docket, where I recap the headlines in true crime for the week. I hope everyone has had a great week so far. And if you have had a great week, I'll probably end up putting a bit of a damper on it with this week's stories because all of them, literally every single one, makes me very angry. We have a grandmother who allegedly poisoned an 11-month-old infant with antifreeze while she was babysitting. An infuriating update in the Ellen Greenberg case. Donna Adel's sentencing, which might actually be the only bright spot in this episode. And then an unthinkable crime out of Cleveland that left a 5-year-old little girl clinging to life. And the perpetrators in this story will shock you to your core. So without further ado, let's get into it. The first story takes us to a place called Okeechobee, Florida, where Anna Adamo, who is 59 years old, stands accused of poisoning an 11-month-old infant with antifreeze while she was babysitting. She now faces charges of attempted first-degree murder, aggravated child abuse, and poisoning charges. The alleged incident occurred in February when the child was dropped off in her care, totally healthy, but then became critically ill while he was in the care of Anna Adamo. On February 12th, the infant's mother dropped her son off at the babysitter. She told police that her son was healthy and at the age where he was not yet crawling or walking and could not feed himself. The mother said she breastfed the child before leaving him with Adamo and supplied her with 2 3.5-ounce bottles of breast milk along with some packed solid food. Throughout the day, she kept in contact with the babysitter by text and was told that the child's well-being was fine throughout the day. According to the police report, at 2:25 p.m., Anna texted the mother and stated that the child was really tired and asked if she could put him down for a nap. The mother said yes. Roughly an hour later, detectives said the child's grandmother responded to Adamo's home and picked up her grandchild. The grandmother noticed that the child was more tired than usual and immediately fell asleep. She told detectives the child slept for roughly 2 hours before his mother came to get him from his grandmother. The grandmother told police that the child did not have anything to eat while in her care, and according to court records, when the child was transported from one car seat to the next, he was lethargic, unalert, and was not able to even hold his head up. So the grandmother voiced concerns that something did not seem right. While traveling in the car, the child's mother told detectives that the 11-month-old baby began to vomit and said that the vomit was not normal in that it was clear, unusually smelly, and sticky. The mother said she called her husband, who told her to go straight to the emergency room. And medical tests reportedly confirmed ethylene glycol poisoning, which is a deadly chemical in antifreeze. And the baby was hospitalized and even suffered from cardiac arrest, requiring doctors to perform CPR for 11 minutes before they were able to resuscitate him. After a week, he was released from the hospital to continue recovering at home, but the long-term effects are still unknown at this point. Investigators executed a search warrant at Anna Adamo's home and found two jugs of antifreeze, one that was missing about 2.5 cups. But get this, this is the second fucking time she has been accused of doing exactly this. So back in February of 2014, she had a 6-month-old in her care, and court records show that the baby was taken to the hospital for being lethargic, and it was later determined that the child could have been poisoned with a household cleaner or antifreeze. The doctor advised that glycolic acid levels were high, but that it could also be from a genetic disorder or poisoning. Tests later confirmed that the baby was indeed poisoned and that it was not a genetic condition. However, no charges were ever filed. And I know you're probably screaming, why? Why were they not ever filed? I don't know. I don't have the answers to that. I don't understand it either. But now Anna's son has spoken out since the incident, making a Facebook post saying, quote, "Until I was 15, I called this woman my mother. If there's any doubt in your minds that she is capable of harming a child despite her reputation and charisma, just know that the last 4 to 5 years of my time with her involved her planting dangerous items on me and, quote unquote, catching me with them, throwing my homework away and reaching out to the schools and telling them not to reassign me anything so I can, quote, learn responsibility, grabbing me by the hair and slamming my head into countertops, kicking me in the ribs, putting hefty amounts of Dawn dish soap in my food and forcing me to eat it, and subjecting me to prolonged punishments and isolation until I could provide an answer to the question of where I was obtaining these items that she was planting on me and in my bedroom and backpack, all while I watched my siblings live jubilant childhoods and bring friends over. After unsuccessful outpatient therapeutic efforts," and then in parentheses, "I couldn't provide a made-up name of a student in school that was supplying me with said items, and DCF visits, I was dubbed delusional and Baker-acted several times." So Baker-acted means like involuntary admission into the hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. So he says that he was Baker-acted several times and placed into long-term psychiatric treatment twice and was forced to take antipsychotics that I didn't need. He continues, I was also wrongfully arrested at 14 for striking her wrist in an attempt to free myself from her grasp on my hair in fear of what she was going to do to me next. She managed to turn that into an anecdote of me walking up to her and clocking her in the face. In conclusion, this woman is wicked, vile, manipulative, and very deserving of all past, present, and future allegations, and I'm done staying quiet about it to appease the family members that still somehow are desperate to defend her. It breaks my heart that it didn't stop at me and that little innocent babies have been poisoned, but to be frank, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest," end quote. So clearly, this, you know, has been a long going issue. The fact that it happened once in 2014 and then again now, and then of course her son is also reporting abuse. It seems like this has been a chronic and systemic behavior. So I really do hope that she is charged and sentenced to the fullest extent of the law. I did see that as she was walking out of the jail, I'm assuming, after she posted her bond, she was walking hand in hand with her husband. So I'm not sure what he knows, but I have also read reports that they initially said that he was not at the house whatsoever at the time that this 11-month-old was there. And then there were retractions made because apparently he actually was at the house. And it's just like, why are you lying about little things? Because in my mind, if you lie about the little things, then you're lying about something so much bigger. So I'm curious to see how this case will evolve, and I'll keep an eye on it and let you know. Next, we had a huge update in the Ellen Greenberg case. It has been over 14 years since 27-year-old school teacher Ellen Greenberg was found dead in her Philadelphia apartment. And it was a case that has haunted true crime followers ever since. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with this. I have covered this case in the past, and I've thought about covering it again just to kind of keep it in the spotlight. But Ellen's story has become one of the most controversial deaths in recent memory. And even now, with a brand new medical review and a courtroom decision, there are still more questions than answers. So for context, here's a quick summary of what happened back on January 26th of 2011. It was the kind of day when most people in Philly were staying home to ride out a snowstorm, and Ellen had left work early from her teaching job because of the weather. They had declared a snow day that day. And by that evening, her fiance, Sam Goldberg, returned home to their apartment at Venice Lofts and found the door locked from the inside with a swing latch. So I'm sure you guys have seen these like at hotels, but it's like a bar that kind of comes around and hooks on this ball, but like you can swing the, you guys know what I'm talking about. Surely I don't have to explain this, but, anyway, it was a swing latch and it was locked. So he's, you know, texting her, he's calling her. He actually called several times and even texted her messages like, "Hello, you better have an excuse. If you don't answer, I'm getting mad." And then when she didn't respond, he apparently forced the door open. And what he found was horrifying. Ellen was slumped against the kitchen cabinets, sitting on the floor, and she had a kitchen knife that was still lodged in her chest. There was blood everywhere. And at first, police treated the scene as a homicide, because who wouldn't? She had 20 stab wounds, later confirmed to actually be 23, including wounds to her head, her neck, and her back, and the back of her neck, and the back of her head, okay? So there were also dozens of bruises in various stages of healing all over her body. But within days, the manner of death was changed from homicide to suicide, and it is a decision that has been contested and discussed ever since because it makes no sense. Ellen's parents, Sandy and Josh Greenberg, never believed their daughter had taken her own life. She was newly engaged, she was planning her wedding, and by all accounts, she was excited for her future. And yes, she had been dealing with stress and anxiety from her job as a teacher, but her parents say that nothing ever pointed to suicidal thoughts. Over the years, the Greenbergs hired their own team of forensic experts who raised serious doubts about the suicide ruling, and some of the wounds were in locations that were nearly impossible for self-infliction, like the back of her neck and scalp. And they also questioned how Ellen could have stabbed herself repeatedly, some wounds piercing her heart, without losing consciousness almost immediately. And I'll get into the details of some of her injuries, but one of them was even in her spinal cord at the C2, C3 level, and it nicked apparently the outer like sheath of her spinal cord. But regardless, it would have incapacitated her. That injury would have, and when you're, it makes no sense. I'm sorry, guys, but inflicting these injuries on yourself make no sense. Don't you think at some point she would have stopped? Like, first of all, stabbing suicides are so rare, but suicides that involve stabbing yourself over 20 times, unheard of, okay? So the family filed lawsuits, they petitioned for access to evidence, and even pushed for the case to be reopened. They believed police and the medical examiner's office had mishandled the investigation, ignoring signs of a struggle and inconsistencies in the evidence. So in early 2025, after years of back and forth litigation, a court-ordered reevaluation of Ellen's death was completed by Dr. Lindsay Simon, Philadelphia's current chief medical examiner. Hopes were high that this review might finally lead to a new classification, maybe even undetermined, if not homicide. But instead, Dr. Simon reaffirmed what the city has insisted for years, that Ellen's death remains ruled a suicide. In her 32-page report, Dr. Simon wrote that she had reviewed everything: autopsy photos, police reports, forensic data, depositions, and interviews. She noted 23 stab wounds, including one that reached Ellen's spinal column, and approximately 31 bruises across her body, like I said, in various stages of healing, meaning they all happened prior to this event and on what seems to be a repeated basis. And still, she concluded that the evidence did not support a homicide. Her reasoning leaned heavily on several points, like the fact that there were no defensive wounds on Ellen's hands or arms. Well, if one of the wounds incapacitated her, then how would she even be able to fight back? Another thing that she pointed out was the DNA and fingerprints on the knife matched only Ellen. The door was also locked from the inside, suggesting no intruder could have left. However, he admittedly kicked the door open, and who's to say that he didn't kick the door open and then attack her? The lock was broken. It was already a fact. We all knew that he broke into the apartment before any authorities or any doorman from the front desk, any witness could have seen him do it, right? So we don't know exactly when that door was kicked in, and that is a sticking point for me. But she also cited Ellen's mental state, particularly anxiety and fear about her job, as possible contributing factors, because she was under immense stress. She hated her job. She was very vocal about how she really wanted to quit and go somewhere else. Like, it just was not working out. However, she had other things going for her, like this wedding, even though there were talks about their relationship being toxic. It just doesn't match up. I know you guys, I know that the majority of you listeners are in agreement with me that none of this makes sense. I just cannot wrap my head around how this new doctor has also come to the same conclusion that it's suicide. She, Dr. Simon, admitted that the nature and number of wounds were unusual, but said it was theoretically possible for Ellen to have inflicted them herself. For Ellen's parents, the new report was devastating. Their attorney, Joe Pedraza, called the findings deeply flawed and shameful, accusing the medical examiner of cherry-picking evidence to fit a narrative that's convenient for the city. I completely 1,000% agree. Their attorney, Pedraza, also pointed out multiple inconsistencies that he says were ignored, like unexplained bruising, missing surveillance footage from the building, and questions about the locked door mechanism that may not have worked as perfectly as investigators assumed. He also challenged the idea that a spinal injury wound could have occurred post-mortem, saying that independent neuropathology experts had already refuted that claim. In interviews, Ellen's parents said that this latest ruling felt like being kicked in the stomach. After all these years, their fight for answers has turned into a legal marathon, and every new ruling in favor of suicide feels like starting all over again. On October 14th of this year, Philadelphia's Common Pleas Court officially closed the case after accepting Dr. Simon's reaffirmed ruling. The city declared the review complete and the matter settled. But the Greenbergs do not plan to give up, and I don't think many of us do either. They've indicated that they may continue their fight in another jurisdiction or seek federal intervention. In their eyes, Ellen's death remains an unsolved homicide, and they will not rest until it is recognized as such. The renewed attention hasn't just come from the courtroom, though. In late September, Hulu released a 4-part docuseries titled Death in Apartment 603, What Happened to Ellen Greenberg? And it walks through the case from the very beginning, highlighting inconsistencies in the investigation and featuring interviews with Ellen's family, friends, and legal experts. The documentary has reignited public debate, especially online, where thousands of viewers are now demanding accountability and transparency from Philadelphia officials. For the Greenbergs, the show represents more than just awareness. It's proof that people still care, that their daughter's story is not forgotten. So as of now, the official cause of death remains a suicide, and the Greenberg family continues to dispute that ruling, calling it a cover-up or, at best, a complete failure of the system. And the public, which is fueled by documentaries and independent investigators, continue to ask how a young woman could suffer 23 stab wounds, some to the back of her head, and yet have her death called a suicide. For now, Ellen's case is quote-unquote closed, but if history tells us anything, this is not the last time we will hear her name. Her parents are still fighting, her supporters are still demanding answers, and the truth, whatever it really is, still feels out of reach, but we're not going to stop talking about it. I certainly won't stop talking.
Organic, farm-grown, never lab-made, these are the ultra-premium CBD gummies from Secret Nature, crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to support your day with clean, purposeful functionality. For me, I like keeping a Bliss gummy on hand when I've got a packed schedule and need steady focus without that jittery feeling. It's just clean, balanced energy that helps me stay in the zone. And when the day is over, I reach for a snoozer's gummy to actually unwind and put a real stop to my day. It feels intentional and it slides right into my routine. And here's what sets them apart. They're organic, farm-grown, and never lab-made, ultra-premium CBD gummies with real botanicals, nothing extra. And you have two options. You have Bliss for clear focus and productive flow, and then you have Snoozers for rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's no guessing. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 30% off. That's secretnature.com, code MAMA. Have you heard of Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth? It's the supplement designed to help women maintain optimal hormone levels. With more than 50,000 glowing reviews worldwide and 98% of women saying that they would recommend it to their friends and family, it's clear why it's such a fan favorite. And now you can take those results even further with their prebiotic collagen protein. This product is all about supporting your gut health, which directly impacts your hormones. When your gut is in balance, it can really amplify the benefits of hormone harmony. So here's what it helps with. It helps with relieving occasional bloating and gas, check. Reducing sugar cravings so you feel satisfied longer, definitely need that. Supporting healthy, sustainable weight management, which is something I have always struggled with. And boosting energy and supporting general well-being. Again, I think all moms can probably relate to basically all of those symptoms. But personally, I've noticed that adding prebiotic collagen protein to my routine made a big difference. It's given me more energy during the day and just an overall feeling of balance, like I'm not on this wild roller coaster of hormonal imbalance. And what I really like about Happy Mammoth is their commitment to quality. Their products are inspired by nature, but backed by science, and they never cut corners. Right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and Hormone Harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order with the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, at checkout. Just go to happymammoth.com and use the code MAMA for 15% off today.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
About it, and I encourage you to do the same. Our next story is another one that I have talked about before, and it involves the murder of Dan Markell and his ex-wife Wendy and her family's involvement in his murder. So Donna Adelson has been a polarizing figure in one of the most tangled true crime sagas of the decade. And this week, the long-running drama reached a new turning point with a sentencing that locks her into decades behind bars if she even makes it that long. She's like 80, but far from answering all the lingering questions that many still have. Now, to understand the weight of this sentencing, we need some backstory. In July of 2014, Florida State law professor Dan Markell was shot and killed in the driveway of his Tallahassee home. two bullets to the head while returning from the gym. Now, Dan had been embroiled in a nasty custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson, who is Donna's daughter. Wendy wanted to move with their children to South Florida, and Dan was very resistant of that. Over the years, multiple people connected to the plot were arrested and convicted, including Donna's son, so Wendy's brother, Charlie Adelson, who was found guilty and sentenced to life plus 30 years in 2023, and then also Catherine Magbanua, who is Charlie's ex-girlfriend and alleged intermediary who kind of hooked him up with the hitmen, who were Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera. So Garcia got life and Rivera pled and then got 19 years. I think he might have gotten the least, if not the second least, of all these charges, which is just kind of crazy when you think about the fact that Wendy and Donna and Charlie were really kind of the masterminds of this, allegedly, for educational purposes, because Wendy has not been charged. But I mean, how could she not have known? But it's just interesting that all of the puppeteers got harsher sentences than the actual hitmen, it seems like. But anyway, Donna Adelson remained free from arrest until November 23, whenever she was detained at Miami International Airport, reportedly trying to board a one-way ticket to Vietnam, a country without a U.S. extradition treaty. And it was actually as she was about to get on the gangway to enter onto the plane, she made it so close, and then they captured her right before she was about to get on. Now, originally, her trial was scheduled for September of 2024, but delays and legal challenges postponed it. And then finally, her trial began August 22nd of this year. Testimony dove deep into the custody dispute, financial movements, wiretaps, family tension, and then alleged communication linking Donna and others to this whole plot. On September 4th, the jury returned a guilty verdict on all counts, including first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation to commit murder. That set the stage for this week's big moment, which came on October 13th, this past Monday, when the court delivered the sentence, life in prison without the possibility of parole for the murder charge. On top of that, Donna Adelson received an additional 30 years for the conspiracy and solicitation convictions to be served consecutively. So she will likely die in prison. In court, Donna maintained her innocence. She declared that she never ordered or planned the killing and claimed the state lacked proof. She said, and I quote, "If I had become aware of this plan before Danny was murdered, I would have stopped it. I swear to you, I was not involved in any way." And then Judge Stephen Everett, however, criticized her statement as showing an utter lack of remorse. So here is a clip from that sentencing hearing.
"Where is the evidence before July 18th, 2014 at 10:50 in the morning?"
"Before you continue, Mrs. Adelson, as it relates to this statement, is the defense trying to re-argue the trial?"
"No, Judge, just giving Adelson an opportunity to be heard."
"Mrs. Adelson, you certainly can continue. However, the court can take into consideration the utter lack of remorse that you are displaying. Please proceed if you desire to do so."
"Where is the evidence before July 18th, 2014 at 10:50 a.m. that revealed that I had any involvement in this vile and horrific act? Where is the solicitation and conspiracy evidence? The state needed to show that there was evidence before the murder to convict me. The state couldn't show that because there wasn't any evidence. They were trying an innocent person. It makes you wonder if the jurors were sleeping when the state had Sergeant Corbett on the stand for hours. Their own star witness testified that my phone was never, I repeat, never at my son's house on the night of the murder. The state's theory that my husband and I dropped off money to my son was blown out of the water by their own witness. And yet, the state continued to push that story, that lie of the so-called money drop, to the jury through the remainder of the trial."
So first of all, I love how the judge is like, you know, they're going to consider the fact that you have an utter lack of remorse. But if you feel like continuing, then, you know, go ahead. And there's a pause. And then she's like, where is the evidence? And she just keeps going. And then even goes as far as to insult the jurors. I mean, the lack of self-awareness is actually astonishing and comedic, if you ask me. But importantly, the judge also denied her motion for a new trial. Her attorneys had argued juror misconduct, speculation in the verdict, and insufficient evidence, but Judge Everett rejected those claims, holding that the verdict was backed by credible testimony and exhibits. So as of now, Donna is heading to serve a life sentence and her legal team is left with appeals as their recourse. And even after a life sentence, many mysteries still persist. Like, what level of involvement did Donna truly have? Was she the mastermind or a facilitator? I think we can all agree that she was involved somehow, but to what extent, I don't know if we will ever really know because she can't even tell the truth. But also, how much did other family members like Wendy or Donna's husband Harvey know or participate? Now, Wendy has long denied any involvement and so far faces no charges. I think it's also important to note that Donna is now the fifth person convicted in connection with Dan Markell's murder, and I think that underscores the complexity and the number of moving parts in this case. So Donna Adelson has officially been sentenced, effectively closing one of the most dramatic chapters in the Markell murder saga. The courtroom battle is over for now, but in true crime, the end of a trial doesn't always mean the end of the story. There's still appeals, there's public debate, and unanswered questions, which mean that the discourse is really just shifting arenas. And I have a feeling there is still more to come, especially as it pertains to Wendy. So I will certainly keep you updated. And if you want the full story on this, I do have an episode on the murder of Dan Markell. It's episode 170, if you want to go back and listen to that to kind of just refresh your memory on this story. It is a pretty wild one. Now, the next story and last story that I'm going to tell you is deeply disturbing. And I'm going to try really hard not to cry when I tell you guys this story, but I think it's important that we lay out the story with clarity, respect, and the attention that it deserves. A 5-year-old child was dropped off at a family member's home on Sunday, September 13th, and would never return the same. What occurred in the hours after that drop-off set off one of the most shocking child abuse cases in recent memory because now two children, ages 9 and 10, have been charged in connection with the attack. The allegations are extremely serious, and the community, the victim's family, and the justice system are all grappling with how to proceed here. So it was a Sunday, September 13th, in Cleveland, Ohio. Nothing about that morning would have suggested what was coming. The girl's mother, Antavia Kennebrew, dropped off her daughter at a family member's house on the city's east side, and she thought that her child would be safe there, maybe watching cartoons or playing outside. But sometime later, that changed. According to the family, the little girl somehow walked out the front door. Exactly how or when remains unclear, but what we do know is that by the time Antavia saw her again, her child was no longer the same little girl that she had kissed goodbye that morning. First responders found the 5-year-old a few blocks away in a grassy area. She was barely conscious. Her tiny body was battered and bloodied. Paramedics rushed her to the hospital where even seasoned emergency workers reportedly struggled to process what they were seeing. Her mother later told reporters that when she arrived at the hospital, she could hardly recognize her daughter because her scalp had been torn in places. Huge clumps of her hair had been ripped out. To give you an idea of what we're looking at here, this little girl, and we don't know her name because she is a minor, but this little girl is a black little girl. She's got these braids, these beautiful braids in her hair, and the braids were ripped out, like all the way out of her hair. I'll try to include a picture of the top of her scalp just so you can see what we're talking about, because it's not just simple, oh, we pulled out some hair. I mean, she is effectively scalped nearly, and her face and her body were covered in bruises and dirt. Blood was filling her eyes, her lips, and her mouth. Her fingernails were packed with mud, which is a haunting sign that she had fought for her life, that she had tried to claw her way out of whatever nightmare she was trapped in. And according to the mother's account, the attackers tried to strangle this five-year-old with her own shirt. They beat her with their hands, and they sexually assaulted her. She also said her child had been urinated on, which is just a level of brutality and humiliation that is hard to put into words. At one point, the little girl lost consciousness, and doctors later told Antavia that it was a miracle that she survived at all. Within days, investigators from Cleveland's Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit traced what had happened, and witness accounts and physical evidence led them to two suspects, both children who live in the same neighborhood. One is a 9-year-old boy and the other a 10-year-old girl. When prosecutors announced the charges, the list stunned even veteran court reporters. Attempted murder, rape, felonious assault, kidnapping, and strangulation. And because of their ages, both suspects are being charged in juvenile court, and their names are being withheld from the public. The case was assigned to the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, which said in a statement that it was one of the most sensitive and disturbing investigations they had ever handled. As the story broke, the community reacted with disbelief. Parents in the area asked how something like this could happen and how children so young could be capable of such cruelty. Meanwhile, Antavia Kennebrew was solely focused on her daughter's recovery. She told local reporters that her child was undergoing multiple surgeries and trauma counseling. And through tears, she said, quote, "She's my baby and I don't understand how anyone could do this to her," end quote. Now, doctors say the girl faces a long road ahead. She's healing physically, but the emotional scars are something that medicine can't touch. The details of what happened in those missing hours are still murky. Investigators haven't said exactly how the girl ended up in that field or what motivated the two other children. Was it planned? Was it a violent game that spiraled out of control? Was it something that they had seen or experienced themselves, which I'm likely to believe could be true, considering they're only 9 or 10? Like, kids don't just think of these horrific things without having seen it before, right? But those are the questions prosecutors, psychologists, and the court system now have to wrestle with. And it's not just about finding out what happened. It's about deciding what justice even looks like when the alleged perpetrators are still years away from even middle school. We're talking like fourth and fifth graders. Because here's the thing, a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old can't be tried as adults in Ohio. The law sees them as children, children who may not fully understand the permanence of what they've done. And that leaves prosecutors in a tight spot, because how do you hold them accountable while acknowledging that they're not yet old enough to comprehend the meaning of life in prison? So cases like this are really almost unheard of. While older teens are sometimes tried as adults in violent crimes, it is exceedingly rare to see charges like attempted murder or rape brought against anyone under 10 years old. Juvenile courts typically focus on rehabilitation, not punishment, but how do you rehabilitate children accused of doing something so heinous? I really don't know. I don't know that it's possible. Psychologists will likely be brought in to evaluate both of the suspects to determine their mental capacity, their understanding of right and wrong, and any history of abuse or behavioral issues. Those findings could shape everything that happens next. But for now, the little girl's identity remains private as she continues treatment. The suspects remain in juvenile custody as court proceedings move forward. The legal process will be slow, as it always is, slow, methodical, and largely closed to the public because of the ages involved. But outside the courtroom, the conversation has already begun. Parents are asking how to protect their own kids, not just from strangers, but from the possibility of violence among children themselves. As if we don't have enough to protect our kids from, now we've got to protect our kids from each other. I don't want to live in this world anymore. Like, this makes me lose faith in humanity. Advocates are calling for better mental health programs and early interventions for at-risk youth. And through all of it, One mother just wants her daughter to feel safe again, to be able to laugh again, to play again, and to be five years old. My littlest is one, but our little boy Augie is about to be four, and I just cannot imagine him being like having to go through something so traumatic when you're that little and you really just don't know. And like when you're five, you just see the best in people and your view of the world is usually untarnished as it should be when you're five. So just thinking about what this little girl has gone through enrages me and has me thinking a lot about what do we do? What do we do to help? Like, where's the purpose in this? Something's got to give, something has to change. Where does it even start? I don't know. But with that, I don't even know how to tell y'all to have a good weekend. Have as good of a weekend as you can after hearing that, because I know it's awful. But I think stories like this just remind us to stay curious and stay vigilant, especially when it comes to our kids. And I guess that's all I have for you today, guys. If I'm being completely honest, I think I'm just getting a little burnt out on some of these stories because they're just so bad. And I just, the empath in me wants to figure out a way to help, but I don't even know what that looks like anymore. So if you have any ideas, you let me know. Now, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.